1940, 10th of May, just over 25 years after Germany had invaded France at the beginning of the First World War. They did it again, this time Nazi Germany. They did it in great strength and at high speed with tanks and planes and all sorts of armor, and followed up by infantry. This was called Blitzkrieg, Lightning War, and what it was about was going so quickly that people didn't know what the hell had hit them and were terrified and ran away. That's pretty well what happened. They knocked back French troops and a large number of British troops pretty rapidly. Within 2 weeks, they had reached the sea, the west coast of France, northwest coast of France. On the 27th of May, that's 17 days after the invasion began, only 17 days, that's really the beginning of term, if you like, the British army was holed up on the beaches at Dunkirk, and the navy and fishing boats were coming across and extracting them. And when they'd got as many British troops off as they could, they then took off as many French as they could, but that wasn't so many. So an enormous number of French troops ended up in prisoner of war camps in Germany. A day after the Dunkirk rout ended, that lasted a week, German tanks and bombers turned on Paris, and hundreds of thousands of civilians, if they hadn't fled already, fled then to the provinces. The government itself decamped to Bordeaux, and on the 10th of June, exactly 1 month after the invasion had begun, the French government declared that Paris was an open city, in the sense that they washed their hands of it, basically. And 12 days after that, on the 22nd of June, France surrendered entirely. It was initially divided, fairly soon it was divided into two regions. The north and west, strategically important because bordering on other countries and particularly bordering on the sea and the channel, were under full occupation by the German army. The rest was declared a kind of free zone. It was under a French puppet government called the Vichy government, run by Marshal Pétain, our dear Maréchal, as the Vicomtesse calls him, the Vicomtesse de Montmore in Suite Française. As I said, hundreds of thousands of French troops were taken prisoner. You get the sense of that from these novellas, don't you? And meanwhile, France was required to pay the costs of the German army in occupation. So there were resulting economic shortages and also, of course, shortages of labor, particularly agricultural labor, and great difficulties in communications by road. The result of that was that food supplies were screwed up. A lot of people went hungry. So if you had land and animals and chickens and so on, you were okay. If you didn't, you weren't. And again, you feel the rapid intensification of that social division in Suite Française. In 1942, when the Allies invaded North Africa, the south of France became vulnerable and strategically more important. And at that point, the whole of France was occupied by Germany. And it coincided that with Hitler's decision to rid the whole of Europe of Jews. Of course, anti-Semitism had been an intrinsic part of the Nazi program from very early on, from the early 30s. But now in 1942, people began to be deported from countries like France into the places where there were concentration camps, like Poland with Auschwitz. It's estimated that a quarter of the Jewish population of France died then, and among the victims were Irene Nemirovsky and her husband, Michel Epstein. Now, the two interconnected novels which make up Suite Française were written in France between 1940 and 1942. And much of what they describe then derives from the experiences of Nemirovsky herself. Their children were evacuated early on to a provincial village called Issy-l'Évêque, and in Burgundy, a hilly region of Burgundy. And it was to that village that in the early summer of 1940, when Paris became too dangerous, or thought to be too dangerous, that Irène Némirovsky and her husband themselves moved. Issy is the village on which Bussy in Suite Française is modelled. Now, Némirovsky at this time, by this time, was an exceedingly successful writer in France, one of the most successful French writers of the time. She was the author of 13 novels published between 1927 and 1940. Russian by origin, as her name suggests. Her father was a rich banker. She was brought up until her early teens in Kiev. But in 1917, the family left Russia to escape from the Russian Revolution, and they settled in Paris. That was not such a difficult thing for them to do, partly because they were very rich, and partly because, like most bourgeois and sophisticated, well-off Russians, they spoke French very well. They used it as a main language. And so Irène Némirovsky settled in pretty quickly in Paris. She went to the Sorbonne, to university when she was 18, and she started to write. And by her early 20s, she was being published. Her second novel, which is called David Golder, David Golder, I suppose, was published in 1929, and it was made into a film by Jean Duvivier, at the time a very notable, or he became a very notable film director in France. This movie was his first big hit. It was also made into a stage play, and that counted for things in terms of the spread of ideas, too. I'll come back to David Golder later. David Golder was also published in translation in the USA, as was another of her novels called Jezabel, 1936. She also wrote a biography of Chekhov, which was published posthumously, and it itself was translated into English. But her big success and fame didn't come till about 5 years ago. Suite Française was unfinished. It's important to remember that when you're talking about it and thinking about it and reading it. And it was conceived as part of what were to have been five novels. The unfinished manuscript was inherited after her death in Auschwitz by her elder daughter, Denise, who thought at first glance that it was a diary and that it was going to be too painful to read, so she put it aside. Much later, in the late 1990s, she was arranging for a French archive to take all of Irène Némirovsky's papers, and so had a closer look at it. She realized that she'd got something rather special, that it was different from what she'd thought, that it hadn't been published, of course, and decided to offer it for publication. It appeared in 2004 in France. These details, the dates and names and so on, are on the handout. And it won a major French literary award. Among its first readers was someone called Carmen Carlil, a very powerful Australian-British literary entrepreneur. She's one of the people who founded Virago Press. She'd recently, Carmen Carlil, been working on a book about Vichy France, a very interesting book called Bad Faith. And she, Carmen Carlil, was passionate about this book of Irène Némirovsky's. She had begun her career as a publicist, and she went round talking the book up made sure that it found a home at Vintage, which was a publishing house in Britain that she was associated with. And it became a runaway bestseller when it was published in 2006 in Britain and in the USA just 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 4 years ago. And it became, as I say, a runaway bestseller. Now, is it a good book? Is it what G.K. Chesterton and after him George Orwell called a good bad book? Or is it something else? That's what I want to think about this afternoon. We have to remember, of course, that most of its readers only know it in translation, and that, as I said, it's unfinished. But despite these disadvantages, I think most people would agree that it has strong, suspenseful storylines, and it gives detailed, generally indignant, but sometimes affectionate portraits of French society under pressure. The indignation is important. Nemirovsky was a satirist. She painted in bold colours. She was particularly alert to the divisions between rich and poor, to the quite separate, though related, differences between the classes, especially in provincial France, and also to the moral deformations which great wealth can not only derive from, but actually encourage and nourish. She has been somewhat exaggeratedly compared with Dostoevsky. I think she's more closely linked to Nikolai Gogol, another Russian writer who had a very clear ethical set of views he wanted to put across. I'll come back briefly to him later. But you can find roots also in Balzac with his large castes of French people of all kinds, and further back in Molière with his caste lists of hypocrites and misers and people who are, as I say, painted in bold colours in order to be satirised. Most of Nemirovsky's bourgeois characters, and you see this particularly in Suite Française, are defined by their possessions and by their possessiveness. The evacuation of Paris in the first of these novellas is conveyed as what it was, a crisis of transport, in terms not only of whether people could get to their destinations and how, but of how far they could take their possessions along with them. In communicating this chaos, Nemirovsky selects character types whose particular relation to their possessions sharpens the inevitable irony. So we have the rich collector, Charles Langelet, wondering what he's going to do with the wonderful objects he's collected, wrapping up his porcelain and packing up as much of it as he can in his car. We have the Perricon family, old, established, middle class, with a whole lot of inherited furniture, thinking, well, we can't leave without our embroidered sheets. We have to wait till they get back from the laundry. And we have Gabriel Court, the writer's mistress, Florence, and her jewels, the possessions that she has gained through her life as a courtesan. What distinguishes the modest couple, the Michaud, in the first volume, the heroes of that novella, is that they trustingly leave their belongings tidily in Paris, and indeed when they go back they find them there and nothing bad has happened to them. Trust, though, is very often misplaced in Nemirovsky's work, as we learn vividly from the fate of the priest from the Perricon family, when the orphan boys in his care find themselves in the wilds not only of the French countryside but of the collapse of social order. They enact their own mini-revolution, killing the priest and sacking a chateau. That's what happens in revolutions, and particularly happened in the earlier French Revolution. Now, all this action and the introduction of all these characters happens very, very rapidly. The variety of the characters, the violence, and in some cases the justice of what befalls them, the very powerful sense of a greater and more arbitrary violence looming, all this carries the reader along, and it's counterpointed by the unexpected calm of the first half of the second novella. Here, in the second part, while the satire on French snobbery and materialism continues, the melodrama of part one initially gives way to the romantic scenario of the relationship between two unhappily married but idealistic people, idealistic in the sense that they're not going to consummate that relationship. You know, in a way, it's a kind of Franco-German version of Noel Coward's Brief Encounter, if you know that movie, a pre-war play which in part owed its post-war popularity, it was made into a movie in 1945, to wartime separations and infidelities. The difference, of course, is that Lucille and Bruno are on opposite sides, and that Nemirovsky deploys the relationship as a way not only of commenting on the meaninglessness of war in terms of individual humans, but of depicting a good German. And it's very often said about this book, written in 1940, 41, 42, what an extraordinary thing it is that Nemirovsky should have been able, in those circumstances, to depict a good German. Now, I'll be offering a different interpretation in a moment, but I'd like to suggest first that despite some very ambitious claims which have been made for this book, which, as I say, only hit the Anglophone world in 2006, was only published in 2004, it's still new in that sense, and which brought with it the reissuing of a whole lot of the translation for the first time of a lot of Nemirovsky's work, that despite all the claims that have been made for it, it is a good bad book, as Orwell anatomized that category. He wrote, and the quotation is on the handout, and you've read the essay anyway, I hope, "One can be amused or excited or even moved by a book," we would, I'm sure, add by a movie or a TV series, "a book that one's intellect simply refuses to take seriously. Art," he says, "is not the same thing as cerebration, thinking. In novelists, almost as much as in poets, the connection between intelligence and creative power is hard to establish. Enough talent to set up dozens of ordinary writers has been poured into Wyndham Lewis's so-called novels, such as Tower or Snooty Baronet. Yet it would be a very heavy labour to read these books right through. Some indefinable quality, a sort of literary vitamin, is absent from them." Now, there's more going on in Orwell's short essay than might appear, I think. Among other things, his account of the fiction of Wyndham Lewis, an exact contemporary of Virginia Woolf, whose reputation Orwell also thought inflated, arguably introduces a category which Orwell doesn't mention, which is the bad good book, a book that has enormous imaginative and intellectual power behind it, but which doesn't make it as a novel, doesn't quite grab the reader. Again, I'm going to say something about that now. I think that to think about the bad good book is useful, not in connection with Suite Française, but two works by contemporaries of Nemirovsky's in France, Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, both of whom, they were philosophers, of course, both of whom wrote novels set in wartime France. Sartre's La Mort dans l'âme, The Iron in the Soul, it's translated as, that's again is on the handout, which is the third part of a trilogy set in about the war, includes a powerful, very powerful depiction of the exodus from Paris. And Simone de Beauvoir's Le Sang des Autres, The Blood of Others, which was made into a movie by Claude Chabrol, starring Jodie Foster, if you're interested, is, among other things, about moral dilemmas involved in resistance to an occupying power. So these two novels, by very, very eminent French thinkers, bear direct points of comparison with Nemirovsky's two novellas. I'm not going to go into them in any detail because there isn't time, and because I hope that those of you perhaps who are doing English and French, or those of you who are simply interested, may want to do so yourselves. If you do literature of World War II next year, or the year after, you have a chance to anyway. But the point I want to make is that those two books, to me at any rate, exemplify what Orwell means by over-cerebration in fiction. Books that have too much intellectual weight and too little imagination and too little thinking about what a reader wants to run with for their own good. The ideas they discuss and embody are intellectually very, very absorbing. The situations are immensely powerful and moving once you've got the hang of them. But it's very difficult to get the hang of them. The characters don't really come alive. You keep forgetting who they are because they're not. You don't visualize them somehow. You don't get enough to get hold of in them. And the situations themselves can be very obscure. The narrative really never really presses on. And if there's one thing that you can say about Nemirovsky, she tells a cracking yarn. And I just wish quite often that, you know, Nemirovsky had been able to sort of rewrite Sartre's and de Beauvoir's books. I don't think I want them to rewrite hers because it wouldn't have worked. Now, from the perspective of this module, literature in the modern world, all these three writers that I'm touching on undoubtedly, of course, concern themselves with the modern world and what's happening within it. And Sartre and de Beauvoir were personally involved in an activist way in the French Resistance, then in left-wing politics after the war ended, and in de Beauvoir's case, of course, as one of the great pioneers of the post-war women's movement with her book Le Deuxième Sexe, The Second Sex, published in French in 1949, in English in 1953. It's always interesting to see the gap between, the time gap between when a book appears and when it gets translated. Longer for The Second Sex than for her novel. Now, obviously, Sweet Française has some political or at least social engagement. It has a valuable critique to offer of materialism, though it doesn't really suggest what might replace it. And when a kind of version of revolution comes on the scene, as in the case of those boys, it's pretty clear that that isn't something that Nemirovsky, who had fled the Russian Revolution, wants to have anything to do with. The book also movingly juxtaposes the tribalist simplifications of warfare, the ally, the enemy, with the complexities of human interactions in history. The exploitative officer, billeted on the Savary family, points out that his name is French in origin. We've got something in common historically. Lucille entertains Bruno to tea off First Empire China, which her husband's family inherited. China, which commemorates with pictures Napoleon's military expansionism throughout Europe and North Africa, a period, in other words, when France was behaving towards its neighbors in the same way as Germany is in the now of the fiction. Earlier in Sweet Française, when a woman escaping from Paris alongside the Michaud exclaims, "There has never been anything as horrible as this," Maurice Michaud replies, "On the contrary, madame, on the contrary, all too aware that this is what life has been over and over and over and over again in human history." The intense philanthropic Vicomtesse de Montmore, on the other hand, has ideas which are decidedly fascistic about the future of the white race, or the threat posed by the Freemasons and communism. Those are words that are attributed to her thoughts by Nemirovsky. And it's her sympathy with the Germans that leads indirectly to the incident which forces Benoit into hiding. Now, what about that other threat? The Vicomtesse de Montmore talks about the threat posed by the Freemasons and communism. What about that other threat which obsessed Nazism, the one posed by the Jews as they saw it? Now, it's mentioned in passing in a reference to an anti-Semitic poster put up by the Germans in Bussy. But Sweet Française has nothing else to say on this matter. In general, the book's approach to the invasion and to Nazism is that while both involve great suffering, France has behaved just as badly in the past, and in the present is so rotten that a good shake-up may ultimately be for the good. Individually, meanwhile, the Germans we meet are for the most part civilized, there are exceptions of course, civilized, well-behaved, and indeed fine physical specimens. It's worth asking whether, if the book had been chosen by Goebbels for publication throughout France, any changes would have been thought necessary. There is, it's true, a resistance plot involving Benoit, but it's presented essentially as the flip side of the Bruno Lucille story, a husband injured by a bad German's unscrupulous advances on his wife, and partly as a purely class-based drama, the hungry versus the rich. There is nothing essentially in that subplot which is to do with politically minded French resistance people fighting against a tyranny which outrages them morally and politically. Since the Romantic movement at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th, Western readers have come to almost take it for granted that the role of literature is to be in opposition. in the phrase that's very often used, to speak truth to power. That's a phrase, incidentally, which was first coined by Quakers in the 18th century, speaking truth to power. But there have been, in the history of civilization, very many great writers, as visual artists and artists of other kinds, whose relation to the status quo was one of support, even of propaganda. Just as there is resistance literature, so there is literature of collaboration, if you like. Irène Némirovsky's novels have to face the charge, it seems to me, particularly Suite Française, of being collaborationist. And one of the grimmest ironies of her life story is that as a writer, she contributed significantly to the climate of opinion in France between the wars, which made it relatively easy for Nazism to be assimilated and for the French authorities and French individuals to cooperate with the Final Solution from 1942 on. As I've said, among her most successful novels commercially was David Golder, first published in 1929 and made into a film. Like so many fictions published in the 1920s, it's set in the world of the super rich. Unlike many such stories, though, it understands the vulnerability of the wealthy, both in psychological terms and in economic ones. 1929, the year of its publication, was, of course, the year of the Wall Street crash, the beginning of the Depression. To that extent, the book can speak to readers today in particular, and perhaps that's why Vintage have, among other reasons, Vintage reissued it, though I'm interested to know whether how much the issue was debated in that publishing house, particularly by its Jewish editor-in-chief. The central character is a banker, David Golder, and the first word he and the book utter is no. He is refusing to help out his old friend Simon Marcus in a financial speculation which has to succeed if Marcus is to avoid ruin. Golder's refusal leads to Marcus's suicide. All this happens within the opening 9 pages while Golder is on a business trip, and it's not until page 28, almost a fifth of the way through this novella novel, that we see Golder on his home territory. He is getting to be old. He has a tough, exploitative wife with whom he lives on terms of mutual hatred. Their spoilt daughter, Joyce, on whom the father dotes, is more affectionate towards him, but only when she runs short of money. It's like a sort of fable in lots of ways, the extremity of it and the toughness of it and the boldness of the outlines. Both the mother and the daughter are in love with men who have no money of their own, men other than David Golder, obviously. And the affairs are being financed indirectly and unwillingly by Golder himself. All this is put down with relentlessly bleak plausibility, and with Némirovsky's usual close attention to possessions, to cars and furniture and clothes and jewellery. It becomes clear that the aging Golder has a weak heart and that his businesses are in trouble because the stock market is becoming unstable. He survives a coronary, but these events alert those dependent on him to their dependency, to how much they need him to be alive and to be making money. None more than Joyce's daughter, who we see in one of the few really tender bits of the book that carry you away in a sort of romantic way. They go on a sort of sexy foodie holiday in Spain, and they just spend everything she's got out of her father, and they have a really, really good time, and it's really quite nice. And then they realize, of course, the money's run out. Now what's going to happen? The boyfriend is called Alec, and he's broke. So she goes back to see her dad. He has, by now, lost all his money. But he's offered an opportunity to get into a potentially lucrative oil concession in Russia. But partly to teach Joyce a lesson, and partly because he's tired, he says no, he's not going to. Then she starts to work on him. His She says that if she's going to be broke, she's going to have to marry a rich older man in the family's circle of acquaintance. We can hardly call the people in that circle friends. Golda's attachment to his daughter is almost sexual. I'm not implying anything sort of overcomplicated here, but he has a romantic feeling for her, and he finds it impossible to think of her marrying this man almost of his own age, who he hates. And so he decides he's going to go for this deal in Russia. Julian Barnes has written about the book, and he said, how can someone in her mid-20s, he's talking about Nemirovsky, know so much and so well about the harsh terms money dictates to love? That's a very powerful description, but I think it could be turned around the other way too, the harsh terms that love dictates to money, because Golda really is motivated here by love for his daughter. So off he goes, exhausted and sick, to Russia, and he spends weeks battling over the details of the contract which will make her independently rich. In doing so, the novel suggests that he carries out the evolutionary requirement met too by his friend, I'm not sure how you pronounce him, Soife or Soifer, because I don't know the origin of the name, but the quotation is on the handout, who would die all alone like a dog, without a friend, without a single wreath on his grave, buried in the cheapest cemetery in Paris by his family who hated him and whom he hated, but to whom he nevertheless left a fortune of some 30 million francs, thus fulfilling till the end the incomprehensible destiny of every good Jew on this earth. Thus fulfilling the incomprehensible destiny of every good Jew on this earth. David Golda is as merciless in its onslaught on the values of rich Jews as Suite Française is in relation to the provincial French middle class. Now, that's not an easy sentence to utter or to write today. We don't have, however conscious we are of the dangers of generalization, and however many French provincial middle class people may be among our friends, we don't find it too difficult to talk about, generally speaking, the values of the provincial French middle class. But to talk about the values of rich Jews is to raise hackles, and even more if one extends the point, as the novel's characters do, to Jews in general. Golda is self-made. He and his wife both come from the ghetto, a fact which they remind each other of in a particularly brutal scene. And as Golda ages, he returns to his past geographically after he's done his deal in Russia. He goes back to the Ukraine. And also corporeally after his heart attack. Wearing an old greatcoat, a woolen scarf around his neck, and a worn-out black hat, he looks strangely like some Jewish second-hand clothes merchant from a village in the Ukraine. As he walked, he would sometimes raise one shoulder in a weary mechanical movement as if he were hoisting a heavy bundle of clothing or scrap iron onto his back. Now, it's a stereotype, and there are at least two ways, I think, of beginning to defend Nemirovsky for deploying it, and the many other stereotypes which not only David Golda, but much of her other fiction use. First, it wasn't until Auschwitz that they became unusable. Many, many writers had written about Jews in similar ways, and Nikolai Gogol among them, it's partly why I made that connection earlier. And there wasn't any country in the Western world in the first four decades of the 20th century where phrases such as the Jewish problem or our Hebrew brethren were not in currency. Orwell's essay, Antisemitism in Britain, published in 1945, is a statement of fact. Secondly, Nemirovsky wrote as she found. She grew up in the world of high Jewish finance. She'd seen life among poor Jews in the shtetl as well as cosmopolitan ones in Paris. Her description of David Golda communicates a type recognizable to her. And if you're mounting this defense, you would say that of itself, it should provoke no more resistance than, say, Colomb Tobin's portrayals of provincial Irish women with their gossip and their narrowness and their petty revenges. We, I think, go along with Tobin because we know that he's writing about what he knows, we trust his observation, the characters come to life, and that is what they're like. So we might say that if Nemirovsky's world had not been one of Jewish bankers, but of Anglo-Saxon bankers with their big bonuses today, she might have written about them in exactly the same ferocious, satirical way, and she might have produced stereotypes of these bankers, you know, and you can imagine how those would go. You could write such a character sketch for yourself. Nothing, though, can be treated entirely out of context. And David Golder and the film and play which were made out of it helped it reach a very wide, or reached a very wide audience and played into the hands of those on the French far right who had already made the most of a controversial trial in France at the turn of the century involving a French Jew charged with treason, Albert Dreyfus. Now, Nazism, of course, had not yet got going. And the ferocity of the Nazis' campaign, I'm talking now about 1929 when David Golder came out, the ferocity of the Nazi campaign against the Jews only gradually became apparent. But Nemirovsky's anti-Semitism was undiminished by the events of the 1930s. And indeed, there's plenty of evidence to show that she took the side of the far right. She was a Catholic convert. She wrote for some of the most anti-Semitic French magazines of the time, among them Gringoire. It's been said of her the last of her novels to be published in her lifetime, The Dogs and the Wolves, 1940, that had a Nazi publishing house commissioned a novel stipulating the perpetuation of racial stereotypes, they would not have been disappointed with this as a result. This is a book she published in 1940. And when life became difficult for her as a Jew in occupation France, she implored the authorities, among them Marshal Pétain himself, to acknowledge the difference between what she called undesirable and desirable foreigners. She was writing to Marshal Pétain, saying, the head of the regime, saying, look, you know, I understand why you don't want undesirable foreigners, by which she means undesirable Jews, but I'm a desirable one. Give me a break. The terrible story, ironic, truly tragic, of the dealings of Nemirovsky and her husband with the regime in the early 1940s can be followed in the appendix to Suite Française, which some of you may already have looked at, which includes is made up mainly of their correspondence at this time with each other and with other people. New Nazi-directed French regulations militated against the couple by, for example, forbidding newspapers to publish work by foreigners, and then, both more precisely and more broadly, excluding Jews from positions of influence in cultural life. Payments due to them, payments due to Nemirovsky for her work, were held up, and there were letters to her publishers saying, can you find any way of getting me this money? And we're broke. By September 1941, they were not allowed to leave their village without a permit, and permits were hard to get hold of. You have to remember, when you read those letters, that this was the time when Suite Française was being written, when Irène Nemirovsky was writing her books with their wide cast of characters, with all these different types of people in France and how they were affected by the war. Not one of these characters, not one, is experiencing what she was experiencing. Is that an extraordinary thing? That the impositions being imposed on Jews are not mentioned, that there is not a Jewish character in the book written in these years who is suffering in the way she was suffering. In July 1942, Nemirovsky was arrested, and you can read her brief, very brave, moving notes to her husband and children in that appendix. Michel Epstein appealed to everyone he knew and some he did not know who had any power. He pointed out that the family had had German troops billeted on them in Issy-l'Évêque, and that those NCOs they'd had there had written a glowing testimonial saying that how nice they were and how well they'd been looked after. He wrote to the German ambassador in Paris, pointing out not only that the families on both their sides were Russian anti-Bolsheviks, in other words, anti-communist, as the Nazis were, but that his wife's work, he quotes, does not speak of the Jews with any affection whatsoever. Nemirovsky was taken from a police station to a transit camp and from there to Auschwitz, where she went to the gas chamber on the 17th of August, 1942. Epstein didn't know this, and in his desperate, pitiable pleas for mercy, for news, to take his wife's place, what he said, what if I were to offer to go there instead of her? His friends pointed out that that would just mean they had two of you, not one. These pleas continued through September and October, when she was already dead. In October, Epstein's own turn came. Early in November, on his arrival in Auschwitz, he too was immediately murdered. It could have been even worse, as you'll know if you've already read Primo Levi's wonderful book, which we'll turn to next week. But for now, I hope I've put before you in pretty bold terms the questions that I want you to consider about Suite Française. How does it stand up in terms of its own merits, given that it's unfinished? Is it a good, bad book in the terms that Orwell has described in that essay? Or is it a work of collaboration? Was there something in Nemirovsky's mind, which who are we to criticize if it's the case? Who are we to say that we wouldn't do the same if we were famous writers liable to be murdered in that situation? But was there something in her mind which said, I'm going to write a book about good Germans and about how the two sides can live together in harmony, and in which I'm not going to raise the difficult subject of anti-Semitism, and perhaps then, if anybody reads this, they'll realize that they really ought to treat me differently from the way in which other Jews are being treated and we're going to be treated. Okay, thank you very much indeed.